Are you listening? Damn.
And welcome back once again to the Endurance Hour Podcast, episode 358. Alongside Coach Wendy Mader, I'm Dave Erickson. We begin with John today. Thanks for your suggestions about the benefits of riding outside. My question is, when riding hills, what are advantages of staying in the saddle versus standing up while climbing?
Oh, great question, John. So when I started riding, you know, basically when I started multi-sport, I learned a lot from riding with other cyclists. And they always encouraged me to stay in the saddle. The benefit from riding in the saddle is you could really work on your pedal stroke. There's four phases of the pedal stroke: the upstroke, over the top, downstroke, and then the bottom. Those aren't the correct terminologies, but you're able to work on, you know, the full range of motion in the pedal stroke, engaging those hamstrings as you pull back and up, and engaging the quads as you go over the top and down. And you don't necessarily get that when you're standing. Yet at the same time, when you do stand on a hill, you're going to be able to generate more power. So a lot of it does depend on the grade of the hill. How steep is it? And then also how long you're going to be riding uphill. If it's a long, you know, mile or so or more of climbing, you're going to stay seated for the majority of it. And then maybe as you're cresting the hill, stand up, grind through it, get over the hill, and then you have the downhill to coast on. So there are pros and cons of each. When you are standing, again, you're creating more drag. So you're going to be less aerodynamic, depending on the wind. If the wind's at your face and you're standing, that could potentially slow you down because of the drag of standing into the wind. So there's benefits to both. It just a lot depends on your strengths and weaknesses. One thing you do want to keep in mind is when you are riding uphill, you're mindful of your cadence. I used to work with athletes in person riding hills, and I would see that they were so new, sometimes there's a tendency to overspin. So they'd be in their biggest or their easiest gear called the granny gear, and they would just be spinning their wheels, not really going anywhere. So when you're thinking about riding uphill, think about the cadence and think about, you know, having some tension at a comfortable cadence. And most times a comfortable cadence, I'm going to say for most people, is about 70 RPMs. If it's so steep that you're under 60 RPMs, that's probably going to be an indication that you're going to stand up, because once you get to 50 or below, sometimes it's just hard to turn the cranks and it's just going to be a lot easier to stand up.
Yeah, and watching your power as well, because when you get into those bigger, harder gears and you're climbing, you're going to be putting out more power. It depends on how long you're going to be doing that, based on your goals for that race. You could really take a lot out of your legs. And there's also the question, Wendy, of aero position, staying in the saddle versus getting out of the aero position and climbing. I've heard maybe there's a number, maybe 6 or 7 miles per hour, maybe 8 miles per hour. Once you get below that, your aero position doesn't matter, so you can sit up, so you don't have to worry so much about drag or getting in, having the wind stop you. So when you talked about getting up and, you know, not being so aerodynamic when you're climbing, when you get to a certain speed, that shouldn't be a factor.
Right, and that's true. And I was just thinking about, if I'm always aware if I have a headwind or a tailwind, if I have a tailwind going uphill, I want to be as big as possible so that it's pushing me more uphill. Same with even on a flat. If I have a tailwind and it's flat, I'm not so worried about being aero. I just want the wind to push me as much as it can. And there are times where I can stay aero if it's not too steep. I'm just going to say maybe it's like less than 6% grade, you can stay aero and really go at a steady effort where it's kind of a false flat, maybe 4%, maybe 2 to 4% is considered a false flat, where you feel like you're climbing, but it's not too hard. You don't need to get out of the saddle and you can stay aero.
So the benefits of staying in a saddle versus standing, you're still comfortable. You're in that easy position. You're not putting as much effort into it. Standing up, of course, you're blocking. Those are good questions, John, especially preparing for a race. And depends on where you live, what are you battling on a regular basis? And if you want to test yourself, if you have a long hill, use that as one of your efforts to, you know, work into certain wattages or work on your heart rate. Can you expand on this is a little plug for ourselves, but the different for the cycling programs we have and how, you know, standing versus working on your pedal stroke, some of those advantages of those programs that you've put together.
Right. So we have a 4-week plan that just works on skills and drills. And part of the skills and drills has to do with different cadences and, you know, how you feel and different efforts and different heart rates and different powers at different cadences, high cadence versus low cadence. We have a 4-week strength plan where we have for the 4 weeks, it's all about how do you build strength, mainly when you're riding indoors. Mm-hmm. These plans that we have, these 4-week plans are really good for indoor cycling. And then we have one that's just working on threshold and speed 4 weeks where we're taking, you know, the skills and drills and the strength and we're putting them into a threshold speed, which has to do with higher intensity. So it's a balanced plan where you're doing a certain amount of super high intensity versus a certain amount of low intensity. All the plans though do incorporate skills and drills, endurance, strength, speed. Each plan just emphasizes one over the other. And I also wanted to say about the climbing. So, you know, if you're preparing for a race and you're training, you know, look, make sure you know what kind of grades of hills that you might be preparing for in your race and practice standing, practice climbing and standing out of the saddle, practice sitting and grinding and just, you know, find what's best for you and just be prepared. You know, if you know you're going to encounter a 10, 11, 12% grade, you are going to be climbing. So make sure if possible, you're able to do that in training. And if you don't live in an area, which most people don't, with that those grades of climbs, then find a, you know, whatever grade of climbing you have and keep your gear ratio in a big gear so you can simulate a very low RPM range while you're climbing a moderate grade hill. So there's a lot of little tricks you can do in training to get your legs ready and strong standing and sitting for your race.
I did a couple of recon missions, one recently and then one, a couple actually last year or 2 years ago for, one was a sprint and one is a upcoming 70.3 where the races are local so I can ride them. But I timed how long it took me to ride this 1.25 miles, I think it was, a really steep incline of a bike ride. And that way I knew coming up on race day what to expect. And same thing with this 70.3 I'm doing here in about a month or so, is that there's this one climb, and I was giving advice to a first timer a few years back on, all right, at mile, whatever it was, 16, prepare yourself for a 2.5 mile climb. It's going to take you so many minutes. So mentally prepare, physically prepare for that, get your hydration, whatever it is, and at the top of that hill, crest it and keep on going. I was giving some other little advice, but if you can do some recon of your race course, then you are mentally prepared to hit that and you're not frustrated like, oh, this is taking forever, this is super hard. And you can also maybe jot some numbers down, or if you have a power meter or some sort of other stats you can look at later. All right, I wrote at this wattage, this is where my heart rate was, this is how long it took me. All right, now I know where to stay in, or if it was too hard, too easy, I know I can go a little harder or a little less. So those kind of things are helpful.
Yeah, and I just want to throw in one more thing. When I normally don't drive courses before I race them, but I did in Ironman Coeur d'Alene 2008, I believe it was. We drove the bike course, and I remember seeing like what I considered walls. I saw these hills, and I'm like, oh my God, that looks like a wall. But mentally, as I was driving up, I was thinking, okay, got to make sure I shift down before I get to this climb. What gear? What is it going to feel like? And then actually the next day, race day, you know, I forgot until race day how to use the momentum, you know. So a lot of many sections in Coeur d'Alene, in the middle section, was you're going downhill, so you have a lot of momentum, and then you're going uphill and then the downhill. So using that downhill speed as you prepare for the next uphill is really helpful, and making sure you're you know, shifting down and in the proper gear as you're going from a high speed downhill to an up speed. And the hills actually weren't bad at all. They just looked more intimidating than they actually were.
I can visualize the ones you're talking about. And it's also a good time when you're coming downhill, or the end of a downhill to take some hydration then versus mm-hmm. your climb. It's like, okay, I'm getting ready for this. I'm not going to be able to, it's not going to be as easy to be up, standing up on your bike and then try to get some water or eat something.
Yeah, exactly.
This next question from Renee has to do with running. I'm training for my first full distance and running is my weakest sport. I've completed some long runs, just running, and some incorporating walking with this. And generally, my run pace is not much faster than my walking pace. Can you speak more on finding a run-walk ratio for the marathon?
Hey, Renee, you're not alone. So I coach athletes who are kind of in the same boat that they're, you know, limited by their run. Running's their less experienced sport. And same thing, you know, I look at their Training Peaks accounts, and sometimes I can't tell, were you running here or were you walking here? And so my experience with run walk ratios is to go to Jeff Galloway. I think he's like the big guru and kind of creator of different run walk ratios based on your current pace, predicted pace. So he has outlined, if you're going to run a 4-hour marathon, this is your ratio. If you're going to run a 6-hour marathon, this is your ratio of walking to running. So I've used that as my guide as I've coached various athletes. And it seems like the good standard to start with is, you know, 2-to-1, 2 minutes run, 1 minute walk, and then go to 3 minute run, 1 minute walk, 4-1, 5-1. Those seem to be most consistent. I recently was coaching an athlete who was doing, last year she was doing run 4, walk 1. That was working really well for her. And now she's running 2, walking 30. So she's basically doing the same ratio. Instead of 4-1, she's doing 2-30. And she's actually sped up by doing the 2-minute run, 30-second walk. Her overall times are faster than doing the 4-1. So again, it's just a matter of experimenting with yourself, checking that Jeff Galloway site based on your predicted marathon time, starting there, and, you know, seeing what works for you. I know it's important, though, when you do take those walk breaks, they're not, especially when you're racing, you're trying to get, you know, to the finish line as fast as possible. You're not going to fully, like, just casually walk. You're still going to walk at a very steady, you know, speedy pace, but it will give you some recovery time until you start your next run. And then generally the benefit of adding walk breaks is so when you're running again, you're running at a decent pace for you, instead of trying to do the Ironman, what's called the Ironman shuffle or the marathon shuffle, where, you know, you're trying so hard to maintain a running pace, and in actuality, it's not really benefiting you because your form breaks down, you're shuffling, and like you said, you're not running much faster than if you were incorporating those walking breaks.
I know there's a heart rate element to that as well, on letting your heart take a break in that 1 minute or 30 second or 2 minute walking break. So it can help with possibly lactic acid buildup. So if you go hard for 8 minutes, for example, and then take a 2 minute walk or a 1 minute walk, your heart has a chance to recover. And then there's a slow, gradual build again with your heart rate for that first minute or so of the run of your next interval, in a way.
Yeah. And I want to mention one more thing. Like, if you are planning on doing some walking breaks within your race, make sure you train that way. Yeah. It's really important, like, to have a race day plan and incorporate your plan. Make sure you're training that way. Don't just show up race day and say, oh, I think I'm going to walk. Have that plan, whether you're going to do 4-1, 5-1. So you start it right away. Because I've also coached athletes who have a plan to run 4 minutes, walk 1 minute. And then they get to the run, whether it's just a marathon or an Ironman marathon, and they just keep running. And then at the end, they're walking the last, you know, 3 or 4 miles because they didn't incorporate those walk breaks that they planned initially, and their body just wasn't ready to run that full distance because they had been incorporating walk breaks in their training. You want to make sure you do that race day. And one more strategy that I do when I'm, especially in an Ironman marathon, is I only walk the aid stations. And so sometimes, depending on how I'm feeling, I'll start walking the aid stations right when I enter an aid station, because aid stations for an Ironman are fairly lengthy. And as soon as I exit, because this is a commitment I made to myself, I start running again. And then I'm running. I'm like, okay, I just have to run to the next aid station and then I get to walk. So it all depends on how I'm feeling, how long I'm going to walk in that aid station. But I do take the time to walk the aid stations to make sure I get that nutrition in. And then it actually gives my legs a little break and then I'm ready to run at a decent clip again.
I'll sometimes use the aid stations and hold a table or something, for example, to stretch or work, you know, stretch my quads, stretch my calves, stop and touch my toes, work on my hamstrings a little bit. And that's kind of a good time to, a helpful time for me. I haven't, you know, I haven't had issues in a while with cramping, but when I have, that's when I would do it. But those are some good markers. Like, okay, I know how far the aid station is in the full distance because they're usually 1 mile apart. Similarly, in halves, they're about a mile apart, depends on the race. But those are good markers. Like, okay, that's my next goal. And you break it down like that, make it more manageable for the distance.
Yep.
This question from Heather. Thanks for suggestions in your previous podcast about the longest ride when training for a half Ironman. I'm curious, what is the farthest distance you should cycle before a full distance Ironman on race day? And how long before the race did you do your longest ride?
So I'll answer the second part first. The longest training day I do before a full Ironman is usually 4 weeks out, sometimes 3 weeks out, depending on how much I'm doing in that build phase before the taper phase. And my longest ride I've ever done before an Ironman was 120 miles. It was like an 8 hour day, and it was about maybe 5 weeks out. And this was in 2008. And so it just gave me extra confidence to know that 112 miles was doable, and that when you ride over the distance of your race, it just makes that distance mentally as well as physically feel a little bit easier. But generally most people that I coach, I'm going to try to get them to do a few 100-mile rides. So when they're about 12 weeks out from their race, depending on how long I've been coaching them, I'm going to try to get them to do about 300-mile rides within that 12 weeks out. And that's also going to include a transition run or a brick run, a run immediately after the ride. Some athletes will participate in maybe a local group century ride where they're getting a lot of support and aid and riding with other people. That's usually what I encourage beginner athletes to do instead of doing it alone. Some athletes, due to just getting lost on their course, will ride over 100 miles. I don't think it's necessary to do that. I think, though, once you hit that 100-mile mark, it's going to give you a lot more confidence. Some athletes that I currently coach have asked me, because they've seen other coaches talk about that they only need to ride 80 miles before their Ironman. And for me, that's not enough, because for me, you have to get to 80 miles to feel what it's like to ride 112 miles. I've gotten to 80 miles in many Ironman races where, you know, maybe I haven't had enough nutrition or my pacing strategy was off, and I get to 80 miles and I'm like done. I'm ready to be off my bike and I still have 32 miles to go. So I think it's really important that you get beyond that 80-mile mark. That's just my opinion and my philosophy. Again, unless you're really, like, you know, to quote Matt Dixon, time starved, and you don't have the time to ride more than 80 miles or, you know, roughly 5 hours, then that's fine. You know, you don't, everyone's going to adapt and be a little bit different. And know that while you're training for an Ironman, it's not just about the long ride. You have all this other training volume from swimming and biking and running before the long ride that you're doing. So adaptations are going to occur based on the total volume of training that you're doing.
If you don't have time to do an 80-mile ride, or that's the max you can do for an Ironman race, most you can do in training, do you think you have time to do an Ironman and train for it properly? It seems like you need a little more time if 80 miles is the maximum that you can possibly do in your week.
I mean, and that's a true statement as well. So I'm going to say another example of a current guy that I'm coaching. His Ironman's 5 weeks away. And just due to sickness and injuries, he hasn't ridden 100 miles yet. it's been planned, but, you know, just due to circumstances of life, he hasn't gotten his 100 miles. So we're just trying to adapt the program, you know, in the next 5 weeks, what's going to benefit him most in the next 5 weeks so he can safely complete the Ironman. And that's going to include the longest ride we can get him to do in the next 5 weeks, hopefully two of them. Also, we're going to plan a run walk strategy for him so he doesn't try to force the marathon all running. And there's just a lot of variation we have to do in his plan. He had the time to do it. He just couldn't, just due to life circumstances. And I agree, you know, when you're investing in an Ironman, hopefully you're investing in the time commitment in that build phase. You don't always have to ride 100 miles, but hopefully you're going to, you know, plan ahead that you're going to have time to do at least one 100 mile ride.
And I believe you spoke to this in a previous podcast, that if you are a time starved athlete, then, and you don't have as much time to do the full workout, for example, for a bike, then increase the intensity if it's a shortened workout. Can you kind of just do a recap on what that means and why that's helpful for the people who can't do a 3-hour ride? Well, if you can do a 2-hour ride with intensity within it, more intensity than usual, that may be able to bridge the gap.
Yeah, so you're going to kind of get that same adaptation. So if you're scheduled to do 3 hours at a zone 2 RPE 4 to 5, 6 ride that day, and you only have 2 hours, well then, you know, warm up, you know, like 30 minutes zone 2, and then incorporate maybe 3 by 20 minutes in zone 3, zone 4. Mm-hmm. So you're increasing the intensity for a shorter amount of time, and you're going to get similar, you know, a little bit different adaptation, but it's better to ride shorter and harder than ride shorter and easier. Mm-hmm. So if you're going to lessen it out, bump up the intensity and get a little bit different benefit of that workout.
What's your philosophy on brick workouts, bike run workouts?
Oh, I think they're what makes triathlon triathlon. Mm-hmm. Is doing those brick workouts, getting your legs ready to run off the bike. So I'd like to incorporate brick workouts very early on in the training plan in the shorter ways, shorter and easier. Just, you know, you go for your hour ride and then you get off and run 10, 15 minutes. Okay. At no other purpose than to just get off the bike and run. Okay. and get your legs to feel what it's like to run off the bike. And then over the course of the training plan, those short hour workouts, 15 minute runs get harder. You do, you know, an hour bike ride with the last 30 minutes at your goal race pace, depending on the distance you're training for, and that 15-minute run becomes harder. You build your effort within that 15-minute run. And then if you're training for a 70.3 or 140.6, then those brick workouts start to happen on, let's say, your weekends, your typical long training day, where, again, you start off doing, I'm going to use a 140.6, for example, you start off doing a 3-hour ride followed by a 30-minute run at an endurance pace, endurance effort, endurance zone. And then over the course of the training, as you're getting into the race specificity, you start to do those longer bricks at race-specific distance, race-specific intensity, and they get longer. So for an Ironman, I like to have the athlete do 6 hours, roughly 100 or so miles, followed by an hour run, 5, 6, 7, 8 mile run as their longest brick workout 3 to 4 weeks before the Ironman. They're not just doing that. This is part of a slow progressive buildup, because progression's important so your body gets those adaptations and you're not going from a 2-hour brick to a 6-hour brick in 1 week. So it's important that you adapt the program based on your lifestyle and time available to train. And the more times I believe that you can run off the bike, the better for you. So if you're the athlete that's limited for time in corp and you're riding 3 days a week, run off the bike 3 days a week. It doesn't have to be very long. Some days you just have, maybe if you can incorporate just a 5-minute run off the bike every day that you bike, that's going to benefit you. It's just going to lead to certain adaptations that's going to benefit you mentally and physically for the Ironman, or even, you know, a sprint or an Olympic distance race.
This next question from Steve: I am finally getting started with your Couch to Half Ironman plan that I got on Training Peaks. And this, he got that in 2021 and deferred his event to 2022. And looking ahead, I see you have a hill workout suggestion, and I live in Flatland, Florida. What's the best way to revise the plan since I don't have hills close by to run hill repeats on?
Well, thanks for the question. The first thing I would recommend is if you have a treadmill, if you have access to a treadmill, I would try to incorporate the hills workout details into a treadmill workout, and just make sure you're starting slowly. You're allowing your body to adapt to the incline and what it's like for your pace, because again, your pace on the treadmill is not going to be your pace outside. So just, you know, start by just running on an incline on a treadmill, maybe 4 to 6%, and increase, you know, vary your speed just so you feel what it feels like, and you don't want to do too much too soon and get hurt on a treadmill, because this has happened to me, and that's why I'm always hesitant to running hills on a treadmill. Now, when you do run on a treadmill and try to incorporate some incline, you don't have to do the whole workout on a treadmill. I mean, if you can go do a 10-20 minute warm up outside, then do the main set. Let's say it's 6 times 1 minute on an incline. You do that on the treadmill, and then you go do a cool down inside. So some people just don't like the treadmill, but if you have access to and you can do hills on a treadmill, that's what I would say first. And then gradually, you know, increase the incline to maybe, you know, 6 to 8% incline, and increase the duration depending on the details of the workout. I also think doing running stairs. So if you have access to, you know, high school stadium, or, you know, some college stadium that you can do stair repeats on, wherever you can find them. I know when I used to when I coached swim meets at Georgia Tech here in Georgia, they have a parking garage that when I've been training for ultras, I've been doing stair repeats between sessions in the parking garage. People look at me, think I'm weird, but I'm like, I'm getting my training in the best way I can, because there's not really many hills at the Georgia Tech, you know, specific location when I don't have a lot of time. And then also possibly doing, if you don't want to do it on the treadmill, doing it on a step mill or a Stairmaster is going to give you a little bit of little touch of a benefit of running up hills, and incorporating strength training, because the point of hills will get your legs stronger, but the point of hills is also to work on running form. And so if you can do some strength training, if you don't have a treadmill and you are only running outside, trying to do some strength training, squats and lunges, and then go for a run just to fatigue your legs a little bit and get that strength. And if you absolutely don't have anything to do, I would just, you know, go to the track, and I would do those efforts at the track at a higher intensity. So using the example of 8x1 minutes, do 8x1 minutes at the track if you can, or at a high intensity, to get that benefit of the high intensity of running hills.
That's a tough one. I'm just not familiar with living in a flat area. So to think that Florida has nothing in terms of, you know, gradual rises. I know based on the course, there's that one bridge that you kind of climb. But other than that, I just have no experience of living in a flat community at all.
Right. Either do I. And when I did Ironman Florida, there was some hills. Like between miles 60 and 70, there was a nice steady incline of hills, and that just happened to be in the headwind. So it felt like it was a longer climb than it was because we had the strong headwind. So you just want to think about, again, the benefit. What is the purpose of incorporating hills? It's for leg strength, form. When you're running uphill, you're driving your knee forward. When you're running downhill, you're getting more of that heel to butt, more of the butt kick. And so if you can really, you know, it's the ability to do a high intensity effort at a slower pace. And so you have a little bit less impact, but you're still getting the advantages and the adaptations of increasing your heart rate and increasing leg strength. So again, you can get that leg strength with some squats and lunges, and then you can get the intensity flat intervals if you have to.
We're going to finish with this one, and I think maybe you included this into our list today of questions that were sent to us because you're familiar with it enough. This is from Sean. Hello, Wendy. Do you have any advice regarding taking Aleve or ibuprofen race morning? Would you mind sharing your thoughts or experiences with pain relievers on race morning, please?
So, number one, always look at the side effects of any pain reliever. when you take ibuprofen, Advil, that can impact the kidneys. And so I always advise against it. If you get a race bag, sometimes they include Tylenol in it. I think it's because Tylenol is safe to take as a pain medication during your exercise. So I have taken Tylenol before. And so number one, always look at the side effects and always talk to your doctor when possible. So my experience with taking Tylenol was in Ironman Boulder, I think it was 2014. And I had ankle tendonitis. And so I put some Tylenol in my bag when I transitioned from the bike to the run. And that year I had really bad back pain coming off the bike and my ankle felt fine. And I was really glad I had that Tylenol because my back pain was so intense that the Tylenol helped alleviate my back pain. So it was really good that I had it. My ankle pain was not even a factor. So based on my experiences, that's what I've done.
I don't think I've taken anything in terms of pain relievers on race morning. I've taken stuff afterwards for inflammation or just soreness, but never on race morning. And I wouldn't do it for the first time ever trying it on race morning if I've never done it before in practice.
Which is a really good point. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I know Sean's been battling some recent back pain. Mm-hmm. And so he that's why he asked me the question. He's actually followed our 70.3 plan and gave us rave reviews about it. He just completed his race.
Oh, yeah.
In Chattanooga 70.3. Yeah.
Ah.
So even he asked the question last week. I wanted to include it in the podcast because other people might be thinking about it as well.
Well, that's if you don't mind, I'll read what Sean wrote us. This is just not too long ago. He goes, I owe you and Wendy, I owe you, Dave, Wendy, a lot of thanks. I did the work required in each workout, but your training plans, podcast, Training Peaks, comments, guidance, swim analysis, YouTube videos, and the swim lessons in Woodstock were all collectively the lighthouse of direction, motivation, and confidence I needed to get to this point. And I'm not just talking physically. I grew mentally and emotionally as an athlete a lot more than I anticipated as well. I owe you and Dave a huge, in all caps, thank you. I appreciate you. Is that as regarding leading up to the race or after the race?
That was leading up to the race.
Okay.
So thank you for your feedback, Sean. We really appreciate it. And now he did complete the race. He met his swim. He met all his goals. He had a different goal for the swim, bike, and run.
Mm-hmm.
And he met them, you know, despite his back pain, and he actually hurt his foot sometime in training. That has, we don't know what the official diagnosis is, but he was really happy. He said he had a blast, he learned a lot, and he's really excited to take a little bit of time off. And he had also asked the question, I want to share this, he asked the question about taking 6 months off from the pool and what it would be like to come back from taking 6 months off the pool. And now he's saying, okay, I want to get back in the pool because he knows it's going to help his recovery. And he decided instead of taking 6 months off the pool, out of the water, he's going to take a little bit more time off running and biking so he can figure out his back pain and his foot pain. And he's going to instead swim. And also wanted to point out, you know, I followed up with him about his back pain, and he's actually riding a size 56 centimeter frame, and he's really tall and he should be on a size 60.
Oh.
So I have a feeling his back issue as well as foot issue is bike fit related, and he needs to purchase a bike that fits him.
So was this at the 70.3 in Chattanooga, the North American Championship?
Yeah.
Okay. Did he have any other feedback on the day and how the course was?
He didn't send me much feedback about the course, but other athletes did. The swim was long. The swim was lengthened to 1.4 miles, but it was a pretty good downstream. They opened up the dam a little bit to fill the water level was a little low, so they had to open up the dam to fill the water level, and that helped with the downstream part of the swim. And, you know, that race, people get in the water really late. So some athletes started the water an hour or more after the initial swimmers started. So they're out on the course and an hour longer in the heat. And it got, like it usually does in Chattanooga, it got really hot on the run. But it didn't seem to impact him as much as other athletes because he was ready for it. And he's just really excited to move on and do a 140.6 in 2023, probably Ironman Chattanooga in 2023.
It was fun to see a friend of ours and fellow teammate, Jackie Herring, win that for the women.
Yeah, definitely. I was excited for her.
So was I. It was, I mean, I remember talking to her when she was an amateur way back when, 2010, 2011 or so like that. And then through her professional progression, and then the day before, the weekend, maybe Saturday or Friday before she won Ironman Wisconsin, we chatted in Madison there before she won that race. I think she was feeling good and wanted to kind of document her process. Because we first interviewed in Kona on one of the rock walls. I'm not sure if I interviewed. I did. Yeah, I interviewed you down by the beach too.
Yeah.
And we've been, because of our teammate status and also me working for Ironman back then during that period, I was able to see her at a lot of races. And it was almost like a, not a ritual, but a routine. Like when if I saw her or she was at a race and I was at a race, we would always do a pre-race interview. And I would always see her on the course. If I saw her on the course, I would record video of her. And then before this race, I don't think she sought me out, but when she did see me, she goes, "Hey, we got to do an interview." I think she was feeling good that day before Wisconsin. And when she won that, it was very exciting. I'm getting goosebumps thinking about it right now. And then to see her results win that, it's just awesome. It's awesome to see her continue to rise in the female ranks as a professional triathlete.
Yeah.
That's a tough sport as an athlete. You know, I watch these things more and more as a parent now and getting older that, you know, it's hard being a professional athlete in this sport when your job is to exercise. If you look at it that way, my job is to work out every day, or, you know, mom or dad's heading out to going to work and they're on their bicycle and they're coming back to recover, eat, sleep. Mom or dad's going back out to work on a run, you know, a 2-hour run. It's like, oh, the Matt Russell stories that I've experienced and heard and personally heard over the years, like, man, that's his job is to work out. I think it was a famous story among our own circle that at one of our Timex camps, which is just a, you know, a short 3-day period of getting together and sharing sponsor information and clothes and stuff like that, that he would, I think he's at a hotel, he rode one of the stationary bikes for 4 hours, and which is terrible, you know, because it's not his fit, but he had to get his workout in. It's like, oh my gosh, that's a dedication for a professional athlete.
And it's not only just going out for a ride or a run, it's at a certain intensity level.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, you're going to compete at every race. You're going to compete, not just to finish.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
You know, as an amateur, and I've been doing this for 30 years, I'm always competitive at my races. And at the same time, when I know it's not going to be there, and then I'm just going to finish and I'm okay with that. Yeah. Whereas a professional, when they're just not feeling it, then they usually don't finish. They'll drop out and save it for another day. So it's definitely training to compete and training to finish is definitely, for me, a different mentality.
Well, speaking of that, on a personal note, as we wrap this up officially, where are you in your training, and how is training going for you as your kind of your year is in full motion?
So training's going really well. Thank you. I'm trying to get out as much as possible on the bike. Biking is my weak link relative to my competitors. So every time I get on my tri bike, I absolutely love it. I got this tri bike awesome fit last year, and I only raced Ironman Florida, and I think I did one other Olympic distance last year. So I'm really, really dialed into my tri bike fit. I'm just trying to really build my strength on the bike, trying to do, you know, a lot of indoor low gear sessions with power indoors. And then on my road bike, and then I'm going outdoors on my tri bike more for just endurance and comfort and just getting used to climbing. I'm excited. Like yesterday afternoon, I had an hour and I heard the wind, and I'm like, okay, this is my time. I have to get out in the wind. So for the first time, I'm like, I'm excited to get out on the wind because I'm training for Kona and that's what I need to get comfortable with. I need to get comfortable in the wind, and you don't get that from riding indoors. Mm-hmm. And then I also have to start working on my downhill speed. So I'm already looking ahead locally where I can do some efforts uphill and then some efforts downhill. And I'm just really into cycling right now. I was really into running, training for my ultra, and now I'm kind of in that same mentality for cycling. So it's going really well.
It's funny when you think about that, I'm in the same boat. I think about my routes. If it's a nice day, I think about, okay, if I were to do this, where would I go? And what would I encounter based on what I'm trying to accomplish that day in terms of the workout details? And I've already thought about that today. Where can I go to do this run? And do I want to do hills? Do I want to do intervals? How long do I want to go? Do I want to go for time or distance? And there's also, of course, availability of windows of time. I can do a 3-hour ride if I did it indoors. I could probably do a 2-hour ride if I did it outdoors, just because of where I want to go and other preparation elements. Or I can stay inside, which is more controlled. Won't be as fun, but I can catch up on my YouTube videos, you know, watching something on TV or whatever. Yeah, it's kind of funny how we, when we're into our training blocks, think, it's windy outside or it's rainy. Okay, that tells me what I'm doing today or what I'm not doing today.
Yeah. Exactly. You know, there's a lot of pros and cons of riding indoors, a lot of pros and cons of riding outdoors. So I'm really trying to seize the moment. Like, we've had a lot of rain the last few days. And like I said, yesterday it was dry in the afternoon and there was some wind and I had an hour. So I'm like, I got to get out. So I'm lucky. Again, I'm very fortunate because I do work primarily from home and I have that opportunity to, you know, just stop everything and go out for a ride. And at the same time, I'm like, okay, I'm looking ahead. I know it's going to rain. I know these are going to be the times that I'm going to be indoors because I don't need to train in the rain for any reason. It's just, I'm not into that. It's dangerous. So, it's fun. I'm having fun.
I don't know if we talked about St. George World Championship, Ironman World Championship. Did we talk about that at all on the show?
We did not.
You know, from the times I rewatched it, I rewatched a commentary on it, and they were talking about how brutal and honest it was in terms of a bike ride, and even the run was quite challenging in certain aspects of it. And it sounds like it's a really a good course for a championship course. It has been in the past anyway. I know there's been some tweaks in routes over the years because there's been a full there, but now they make it the championship. That I'm not saying go and make that the world championship or move it around randomly, but it was weird to see the Hawaiian signage and elements at the race when you know it's not on the island. Did you catch any of the footage or coverage or highlight clips?
No, I mean, I just watched a little bit of Ironman Live Now or Ironman Now on Facebook in the beginning stages of the race, because that's another reason why I rode indoors that day, so I could watch that a little bit. But no, I didn't even pay attention to, I talked to athletes about the feel of, did it feel like a world championship? But I didn't pay attention to what you just said with signage and everything.
It looked cool. The finish line was amazing looking, with the canopies, the stands, the carpets and the people around. It looked really cool. Like, it was a well produced and put together event. Well done by the Ironman teams to do that, and there's so many people behind the scenes. It was fun to look at, going, wow, this is a high quality event. It's just too bad that they can't do that on a regular basis or make that the Ironman World Championship, because there's so much to Kona that makes it special, which you're going to here in October. That's what makes it amazing, is that it's on the island and it's got that vibe and that feel of going there.
Right. And I think when I think about a world championship, you know, it's a world championship. People are coming from all around the world. I don't think people from around the world are going to want to always come to St. George or somewhere in the United States. I think if they do move it from Kona and they rotate it, like they do the 70.3 world championships, where they rotate it, you know, in 2023, the 70.3 world championships is in Finland. I won't go to that because it's just too far away, and that's not a destination that I've always wanted to go to. and I'm not ruling it out, but at the same time, it's expensive. I have to really want to go to that. So I think the rotation of the World Championship would be okay if that's what they had to do, but not putting it just in one location again. I think if they're going to move it off of Kona, they need to rotate it. But hopefully they'll keep it on Kona.
I think it's where it belongs. And you talk about destinations. More people are, I would believe, family related would go to Hawaii mm-hmm. versus go to St. George, because Hawaii has that, you know, their beaches, their sun, there's palm trees, mm-hmm. that kind of thing makes it more family friendly as a destination. Like, not just mom or dad is racing, let's all go, versus mom or dad is racing St. George World Championship. Okay, you know, best luck, we're cheering you on, but what are we going to do in St. George? Everyone could do something on the Hawaiian Islands.
Yeah, exactly.
I know we said that, you know, finally we'll wrap this up. Just to let people know that we've got some pretty good discussions going on in the T2 Endurance Club on Facebook. We got a really good question here about tubes or going tubeless, and there's good discussions on that. There's some questions of the day for some feedback, and if you want to leave a question in there, we can use that for an upcoming podcast. Any other thoughts before we wrap this up officially?
No, I think that was a good one.
Okay. Well, that is episode 358 of the Endurance Hour podcast. We really thank you for listening and for submitting your questions. Have a great week of training, racing, or recovery. We'll see you next time. Adios.
Adios.